You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Anyway, I'm very happy to introduce Professor Stephen Coslin today. He's the John Lindsay Professor of Psychology in Memory of William James. He's internationally known for his work on mental imagery and has done groundbreaking work demonstrating that imagery is not a simple, unified cognitive function, but is actually made up of numerous distinct events occurring in different parts of the brain. He's recently published work also on visual design based on cognitive principles. The author of over 250 scientific papers, 15 books, and recipient of numerous awards. Today he's going to be talking about the brain bases of deception, and I think the connection, I've known of your work for over 20 years, so I've been following it for a while. I think there's a very fascinating continuum between this notion of visual imagery and mental imagery and these issues of deception about the relationship between the world that we perceive based on what's actually happening in the world outside and our perception of the worlds that are created within the mind. Anyway, so join me in welcoming Professor Coslin.
Thank you very much. So, I'm not going to talk much about visual mental imagery today. Brain bases of deception, why we probably will never have a perfect lie detector. It was interesting. So first, let's talk about the old lie detector. So here's a typical kind of scenario where someone being interrogated, various physiological signals are being picked up and read by the interrogator. Typically, there are four. There's skin conductance coming usually from the fingers, heart rate, breathing rate, and blood pressure. Those are the four standard channels. Turns out it's not valid. There's a good reason why it's not admitted in a court of law. Oftentimes, the polygraphers I've talked to have said that it doesn't even matter that much whether a machine is plugged in, that they are using their own interpersonal skills to read what's going on from the nonverbals from the subject. And putting them in this situation makes them a little tense, so they tend to amplify some of the nonverbal signals of guilt. So it's not valid. Thinking about lie detection, it occurred to me that it's probably a mistake to think about lies as a single unitary kind of thing, that you're trying to pick up signals that are coming out from the brain to the body. That instead, we ought to do two things. One is, we ought to think about lies the way we think about all other cognitive phenomena. Okay? Namely, they're not unitary and undifferentiated. So my father once told me that he had a bad memory. So I said, do you mean a bad short-term memory or a bad long-term memory? And if it's long-term memory, is it episodic or semantic? If it's episodic, is it modality-specific? That was it. He never asked me a question. He sent me a statement like that again in my presence. May he rest in peace. The point is that one of the big advances of cognitive neuroscience is we've taken cognitive functions that seem to be unitary and undifferentiated, like memory or perception or reasoning, and shown that in fact they are accomplished by a whole collection of distinct processes that work together. So, first thought was, why don't I apply that approach to deception detection? So don't think about lying as one thing. Think about it as a collection of different kinds of processes. So what would those processes be? That was the first part. Second part was, why go to the periphery? Why measure the stuff from the body? I mean, the brain is the organ of thought and presumably the organ of deception. So why not go directly to the brain? And then when we have some sense of how the brain is accomplishing different ways of lying, we can think about what kinds of signals we might want to look at in the periphery. So that was the basic approach. This is a very short talk. I was asked to keep it to 20 minutes. I'll try to do that. It has three quick parts. So the first part is we look at distinct brain systems for different kinds of lies. So evidence that different types of lies arise from distinct patterns of brain activity. So here was the first set of distinctions. We've done many more since then. was just thinking about the kinds of processing that underlie lies. You could base a lie on a coherent story that you've made up in advance, kind of a legend, yes or no. And it can be, you can have a coherent story, and it can be made up in advance, rehearsed and stored, or you're trying to do it on the fly. So trying to make it coherent, basing it on something you've memorized. Okay, so the two extreme cells are where it's both coherent and memorized, so you've made up a legend and memorized it, and you're going to use it to generate your lies, or you're just winging it. You're just making up lies on the fly. So we took these two extreme cells to look at, figuring if we couldn't find underlying differences in how they were generated, you know, we weren't going to be able to get much further than anything else. So examples of predictions, just looking at spontaneous, which are not coherent, versus rehearsed, which are coherent. So we've confounded the two. We've only looked at those two cells. Lies, we expect more conflict monitoring to be going on with spontaneous lies, because when I ask you a question, your impulse can be to tell the truth, and you've got to suppress that. So you've got to detect that what you're about to do is not what you're supposed to do in order to convey a lie. So we know the anterior cingulate, part of the brain up here, is critically involved in monitoring conflicts and also helping you avoid making errors. Telling the truth when you're trying to tell a lie, that would be an error. So expect more conflict monitoring and more working memory. So this is where the imagery piece would come in. So working memory is you'd be reasoning as you're going along, trying to think of what spontaneous lie to generate instead of telling the truth. We also expected, with rehearsed lies, going the other direction now, for rehearsed lies, we expected more effort in accessing stored information, because you've stored the information now in memory that you're using to generate your lies. So the parts of the brain that are involved in accessing stored information, such as Brodmann's area 10, in the frontal lobes, ought to be more activated when you're telling rehearsed lies than when you're doing spontaneous lies, where you're not basing them on a stored set of memories. So here's the way we did this, the very first experiment, which was with Giorgio Gannis, several other people, it was published a few years ago. Prior to scanning, we obtained detailed reports from memory of two real-life events. So a very memorable work experience and a very memorable vacation. Okay, those are the two that we asked them to write down in detail, several pages of protocol, find out what had happened. We then prepared a recorded list of statements. You went to the beach, true or false. You went with your family, true or false. You flew there, whatever. Okay. We also helped them prepare for one of those scenarios, work or vacation, an alternative reality. So if you actually went on vacation to the beach, you went to the mountains. If you went with your family, you went alone. If you flew, you drove. So we helped them construct another alternative reality for the event that they memorized. Just one of them. We counterbalanced that over subjects. So half the time it was work and half the time it was the vacation. So we had two extreme conditions in the scanner. Spontaneous, where they were based in their lives were about the work or vacation situation that they hadn't generated the alternative late reality. They had to make them up on the spot. Or the well-rehearsed coherent. We also had several other conditions in here which aren't relevant. I mean, they also told the truth, but that is relevant. But there were two response modes. We had them sometimes verbally responding, what color was the car, who did it go with, and sometimes it was true or false. It turned out not to matter. The results were essentially the same, which is quite good, because in the scanner, when they talk, they move slightly, which makes it just technically a little harder to get the images. So here are the basic results. Let me tell you how to read this. This is a brain. This is clipped a little on the top. Is there any way to lower this just slightly?
On the right side. Blue on the right.
Oh, okay.
One, two screens. Okay, so here would be the eye. So this is like me, from your point of view. So this is the eye, this is the back of the head, and this is the top slice we looked at, this is the bottom slice. So each of these is a horizontal slice. It's one of these guys looked at from the top. Actually, it's looking at the bottom, looking up. So the eyes would be here, for example. This is slice 5, so it would be that one. Okay. So what we've got here in each of these graphs is this is the spontaneous incoherent, the memorized coherent, and truth. So the first one's a spontaneous lie. That's how much activation there was in this area. The second is for the memorized lies. And then we have the truth condition in this area. So what you're seeing here, this is the anterior cingulate, which other people have claimed is the lie center. I'm claiming there is no lie center. Okay, that depends on what kind of lie you're telling as to what's going to be activated or not. So what you see is with spontaneous lies, sure enough, this area is activated, much more significantly activated than with memorized lies or with the truth. Okay. Also, for spontaneous lies, this area here, Brodmann's area, border of 8 and 9, which is involved in working memory, which is the kind of memory you use when you're reasoning, when you're thinking something through. That is more activated also for the spontaneous lies than the memorized lies or the truth. And now look down over here. This is Brodmann's area 10 in the frontal lobes, which is involved in actively looking up information you've stored in long-term memory. Okay, now you see that here, the memorized lies, when you're telling them based on the legend you memorized, that activates this area much more than spontaneous lies or truth. So depending on the kind of lie you're telling, I'd like to go through every one of these areas, but the bottom line is, sure enough, depending on the kind of lie you tell, different parts of the brain are more or less activated. There's no single area that signals whether it's a lie or not. So let's look a little more detail at those slides, of those areas. So here's Brodmann's area 10. That's the area that's involved, it's a frontal lobe area, involved in looking at information stored in long-term memory. So there's the activation. Here is the mean. Here are the means of the subjects over the different conditions, rehearsed lies, spontaneous lies, and then just rehearsed and spontaneous truth. Not much difference there. But this is the result I just showed you for area 10. That is, there's more activation for the rehearsed lies and spontaneous lies. The trouble is, look at this. Can you see these fine lines here? These are for individual subjects. Some go down, some go up. Look at the variability. It's an average. If you look at an individual subject, you can't predict anything. Okay? Cingulate gyrus. This was the famous lie center. There it is, tucked right up in here. So again, we find this mean difference. But if you look at individual subjects, some go the wrong way, some show no effect, some go the right way. Look at that. So tons of variability. When you average over people, you get something. But if you want to know about individual people, it's not going to work. So we've done this with several different kinds of lies, distinctions among lies, self versus other, spontaneous versus coherent, rehearsed, and whatnot. The same story emerges, that depending on the kind of lie you're telling, different parts of the brain are activated. We wanted to push this work further. It's very expensive to do this fMRI stuff.
It's, can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Is it possible that the changes are so fine that they're not being picked up?
Sure, but we are picking up changes. That's the problem.
Yeah.
We're getting changes that some people go the wrong way.
No, but there would be a consistent one that's not going to be.
Well, I mean, so let's look at this one, I think. So here we've got that difference might be significant for that subject. It goes the opposite way of the mean. Some of them, in fact, there's only one that looks flat. So you're right. There's always a sensitivity issue, but that doesn't seem to be a problem here.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So there's two alternative explanations for why you get that variation. One is there's a signal that you get from a person that's encumbered by noise.
Yeah.
And the other is there's no noise, but
the signal's weak.
But the signal is just different in different people. I mean,
right.
Some people, you know,
correct.
It goes this way, and some people.
That's right.
So.
And that's probably right.
Do you know which?
Yeah, I've done actually quite a bit of work on individual differences now. In fact, this work led to work on trying to discover in which areas of the brain differences in activation predict how quickly people can respond or how many errors they make. So we actually changed the question based on this. And your intuition is exactly right. It's actually both. Some areas predict very well across subjects. That is, the amount of activation there predicts how quickly they're going to respond or how many errors they're going to make. But other areas are idiosyncratic. And what may be going on is that given cognitive function, is not necessarily always implemented in the same exact part of the brain for different people. In fact, there's good reason to think it's not. So we got a double whammy there. We've got, in areas where it is implemented the same way, there are individual differences in how responsive the area is, which makes it more or less easy to detect it over noise. And then there are the cases where it's implemented in different areas. And in advance, we can't know which it's going to be. So that led us to take a different approach. Thank you. That was a nice segue into this part, which was in addition to trying to avoid having to spend $1,800 a subject to do these scans, it's about what it cost, we wanted something we could test a lot more people, much more conveniently, much more quickly, and ultimately might be useful. So what we want to do is use behavior, but now guided by what we learned from the brain. So instead of just having a polygraph, we have these four channels that are there for traditional reasons, we're going to now be knowing that there are different kinds of lies, and they may have different signatures. So we'll look specifically for them. So we used an individual differences approach, looking at individual processes that we neurally validated. We know where these, on average, these processes are implemented. So we can use the tasks, behavioral tasks, as a stand-in for looking at the amount of activation in the brain, because we've already established there are these correlations. So let me show you what the tasks were. So the challenge, here's what I'm doing the task for, single participants, single trials. In order to be useful in any way, you've got to be able to take an individual person, an individual answer, and tell if they're lying or not. Okay, it's not going to work with fMRI. So the key idea was to calibrate measures based on individual differences in cognitive capacity and emotional reactivity. Let me show what I mean. So Jennifer Shepherd and I developed something for NASA, actually. It was for the manned mission to Mars. It was a tool we called a blood pressure cuff for the mind. It ran on a Palm Pilot, little two-minute tests that would give you readouts of nine basic cognitive functions. This was going to be used, supposedly, never happened, obviously, on the mission to Mars because they were worried about their circadian rhythms getting thrown out. So they wanted these guys to be able to do a quick check before they went outside or something. It's turned out to be useful, the device that we eventually are patenting through Harvard now. It predicts if you go to the top of Mount Everest whether you're likely to have hypoxia. It's been used by hockey players, hockey teams, to see if it can predict who's going to have a concussion. It's still happening, and various other things. So the tasks on this quick little device, which we wanted to use to get readouts for each individual person, in terms of how good they are at different processes, that in turn will underlie different types of deception. So that's what we're up to. So the vocabulary, the suite of processes that we could look at, covered the cognitive waterfront. So you have three kinds of attention tasks: vigilance, filtering, divided attention. So vigilance is where you have to keep focused on something, waiting for something to happen. Filtering is where you pay attention to one thing and try to suppress something else. Divided is where you're looking for two or more things at the same time. And then there was working memory, problem solving, and there was a baseline of perceptual motor control. I'm not going to go through all these. Let me give you a sense of what these look like.
Could you quickly explain the hockey players that use the prediction was going to have a concussion?
We wanted to know, well, actually, it was recovery. We wanted to know if after they had a concussion, we give them these things quickly, can we predict based on how big the behavioral deficit is, how long and how severe?
Oh, that's very.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
great. Yeah. It's a lot of people are using this for research now. So let me just give you a sense of what this looked like. So let's look at attention. So what do I mean by attention? What is attended to is processed further. It's sort of what you're focused on. If a person is unable to allocate attention appropriately during perception, he or she will not perform well. So we can look at response times in the task. Longer times mean poor attention, error rates, higher error rates, poor ability to focus. So we had three types of attention. Again, cognitive neuroscience taking these basic functions and breaks them down into more specialized sets of processes. Attention, talk about at least these three types: vigilance, filtering, divided attention. Let me just go through these to give you a sense of what it looks like. Oops, sorry. This is what happened when you go from the 2008 to the 2004 version on Mac. So vigilance, maintain concentration over time. respond to each target in a series of geometrical figures. They're flashed up on the screen one at a time. So here's an example of a target. This is a series of distractors. So you say no, 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 and then you wait for this one to come up, you say yes. So you have to be looking and waiting for the right target to come up. So here's, you can't move it over? Okay, so here's what the old Palm Pilot back in the day looked like on the screen. So we tell them you'll see a series of geometric shapes appearing on the screen one at a time. Each time you see what a shape looks like, each time you see one that looks like the one below, push the R key, the one on the right. So that would be this one. And when you see one that doesn't look like it, here's the one you're supposed to push the R key. When you see one that doesn't look like it, push the L key. So it just flashes them up to you at variable rates. So you have to be focusing on the thing, and it goes on for, I think, about five minutes, I think. It's actually quite as long as a test. It's quite strenuous. I went presented this at a NASA meeting, and these astronauts came up, and those guys are so competitive. It was really cool. they're really having a good time. So filtering. So second kind of attention here, this is our filtering task, which gets at selective attention, where you're asked to filter out one stimulus dimension, and select another. So the standard way of doing this is with the Stroop test. So what color is this ink? Quick.
Green.
What color is that?
Red.
That. Okay, you probably noticed it was a little harder than if this had in fact been red ink and this had been blue and so forth. That's a standard Stroop test where you have a conflict set up between the surface features and what the word means. So we used an example of this. So basically a word would come up and they would push the button under here for red as the color of the ink, the button under here for green, button under there for blue. And divided attention, where you attend simultaneously to two or more events or properties. So here you're supposed to respond upon seeing either one of two specified features, either a circle, or blue. So one or the other. So again, it's the same kind of thing. They see what the shapes are, and they get lots of practice before they start in on it. So we have this little handheld thing. It also runs over the web. It also runs on laptops. It runs on lots of other handhelds now. Originally, it was developed for the Palm. So we developed this. These tasks have been neurally validated, so we know what parts of the brain they're activated. And as I mentioned, we've done this work where we correlate, not in all of these tasks, but some of them, the performance with the amount of brain activation, showing that, in fact, the more activated certain key parts of the brain are, the faster people are in most of the tasks. So we're going to use outputs from individual differences, that is, differences in your relative speed and errors on these basic tasks, to predict different kinds of lying. The idea being that, depending on the type of lie, you're going to draw on some of these processes more than others. So I'm going to give you one example of this. It's called the MRAB, which is MiniCog is the shell, basically, device. And Rapid Assessment Battery is these 9 tests. There are other things that run on it. So MRAB is what I've been showing you. So the question, do rehearsed lies rely on the same processes as spontaneous lies? This is a way, we already knew this from the neuroimaging. We wanted to validate the behavioral technique. So we studied response initiation times and two kinds of lies. Here's an example of what we were getting at. If a person shows a small Stroop effect, that is a small interference effect of having to name the color ink when the word names another color, that reflects efficient processing in the anterior cingulate. Anterior cingulate is lit up extreme amounts by the Stroop test. That's probably the best way to get it activated, actually. It's monitoring for potential conflicts, and that's a key example. So if you have a small Stroop effect, a small difference between when it's compatible and incompatible, that's how you measure it. So when it says red and it's in red ink, that's compatible. If it's green ink and it says red, that's incompatible. We measure the difference, that's the Stroop effect. If you have a small difference, he or she should show a small difference in response initiation time for spontaneous lies, because we knew that spontaneous lies activate anterior cingulate, which is presumably trying to prevent you from saying the truth. You're trying to suppress the truth and get a lie out, is why that was there, compared to rehearsed lies of the truth. So do you see the logic here? So we had a task analysis for the different lies in terms of the underlying processes. And then we have ways of measuring those processes behaviorally. So what we're going to do is use scores on the mini-cog, on the MRAB battery that runs on it, to try to predict the time they take to lie, in different kinds of lies. So two domains of inquiry. Participants were asked, again, it's the same thing we did before, bless you, describe in detail two experiences, one at work and one during vacation. Participants then generated an alternative reality for one of the events, counterbalanced over participants. For example, if vacation was in fact the mountains and the alternative reality was the beach, participants in fact flew there, alternative reality drove there, and so forth. Participants memorized the alternative reality to be used in generating rehearsed lies. That was the same as neuroimaging. This is a little different now. Participants were presented with a cue, either T for truth or F for lie, instructing them to answer the following question with either truthful or false response. They then heard a question that was either about the rehearsed event, vacation or work, or the non-rehearsed event. Example, F, which means you should lie, who went with you to the seashore? And they said it aloud. Responses are one word, it's into a microphone. We measure the time from when the question comes up to when they answer. Response initiation time is measured. The participant uses the alternative reality to produce the lie when it's possible. Now, they played a monetary game with a naive observer. We put a camera on top of the screen. We told them there was somebody in the next room, this was not true, by the way, somebody in the next room who was looking at their face and all their nonverbals and was trying to figure out when they were lying. They couldn't see what was on the screen, but they could see them, this observer in the next room. And if the observer is trying to guess when the person is lying, if the observer guesses correctly, that is, says you lied and they lied, or say you're telling the truth and you're telling the truth, the observer loses 25 cents from the amount they're being paid. And if the observer guesses incorrectly, the participant gains 25 cents. We gave them the maximal amount, by the way, at the end, as if they were successful in every trial, so no one complained. But it's amazing, 25 cents adds up for the subject pool to the point where they were motivated. Here's what we find. First, let me look at the spontaneous lies. What we've done here is we've looked at which test scores from the mini-cog, those 12 things, are predicting the response initiation times in the memorized condition and the spontaneous condition. Okay? And the question is, do different sets of test scores predict different types of lies? If so, that's evidence that different underlying processes are at work in the different types of lies. So look at this one first. This is this Stroop test where it activates the anterior cingulate. And you can see it predicts spontaneous lies, but it doesn't predict memorized lies, which is just what we expected. Because spontaneous lies, you've got to stop yourself from saying the truth, which involves conflict monitoring, generate alternative reality. Here you don't have to. Instead, you have to access information stored in memory. So we found that scoring the Ravens, by the way, which is a measure of IQ, predicts the memorized lies times where it doesn't predict spontaneous. Okay. So I could go through each of these and explain why they came out. But the bottom line is different sets of processes are underlying the different kinds of lies. That's the bottom line. Here's the entire array of mini-cog scores. The little green checks are indicating where it predicted. This is overall memorized, spontaneous, the middle two ones that we'll try to look at. What you see is the green checks are in different columns, different rows, rather, and the memorized versus spontaneous, which is the evidence that, in fact, different processes are underlying them. Caveat. So it looks pretty good. But different individual differences predict time to initiate different types of lies. A lot of differences in there. So we're talking about interactions here. So depending on the kind of lie, different individual differences predict the time. Why? because different kinds of laws are drawing on different processes. So individual differences in different processes are more or less relevant, depending on the type of lie. But this is only statistically. If you look at individual subjects, it doesn't work very well. A lot of noise. We're talking p less than 0.01, 0.001 in some cases. Here's the rub. It's impossible to enumerate all possible dimensions. I've come up with about 7 so far, so spontaneous rehearse the two cases I'm looking at so far. We've also done self and other, very parallel results. There's an issue of the journal Social Neuroscience. It just came out, which is edited by Giorgio Gannis and Julian Keenan, which is all about deception. So we have 2 papers in there, the one reporting the behavioral results, and there's another neuroimaging result with self versus other. And it's very much the same story. Different parts of the brain are more or less activated depending on what kind of lie you're telling. A lie about the future versus the past. A lie that's about something that's high versus low emotional. A lie about people versus objects. I mean, we have reason to think each of these dimensions are going to draw on different processes, which will predict things like response times as well as areas of the brain. And here's the real kicker. The dimensions may interact. In other words, the part of the brain that's activated when you tell a spontaneous lie may be different if it's spontaneous about the self versus somebody else, in the future versus the past, dot, dot, dot. So you start getting this combinatorial explosion. So the idea of looking for a lie center of the brain, I don't think it's going to happen. So why we will never have a perfect lie detector? There are many dimensions on which neural systems and their downstream indices. So the brain is affecting the body. But depending on what parts of the brain are activated and so forth, you're going to get different types of signals and combinations going downstream. So that's going to vary. The dimensions probably interact, which complicates the neural localization piece. And finally, Stewart's point. People differ in how the relevant processes are implemented in their brains. So when you put all 3 of these things together, unless you had somebody you could do massive calibration on that one person, discover how key processes are implemented in that one person's brain, I don't think there's much of any chance of having a real lie detector. And I also don't think even the calibration thing with an individual would necessarily be very effective because of the signal detection issues that Michael and Stewart both brought up. So I'm afraid that I can't be too sanguine about the prospects for a perfect lie detector. Distinct brain systems are used for different types of lies. Even when we calibrate individual differences behaviorally and use them to predict individual differences, we get group effects, but we can't get individual items for individual people, and that really is the bottom line for deception detection. Thank you very much.
So we have time for a number of questions and discussion.
Did you ask your subjects how they assess themselves as good liars?
Nope. But notice we were not asking whether people were good liars or not. Every subject did both kinds of lies. Mm-hmm. So it's all within subject. So we were asking about whether different types of lies draw on different processes. So any difference between people would just wash out over that. Yeah.
What was the purpose of the monetary game?
To make them motivated to really lie. So what we worried about is it's kind of a game. And maybe they're not really lying. Maybe they're just playing a game. They're following instructions. So we wanted to motivate them to do something more like real lying. So in more recent experiments we're doing, we have them decide when to lie. So we
but
don't.
You also had them trying to make the person think they were lying when they were telling the truth.
Right. So we wanted to motivate them to do that. Right. Okay. That's right.
And that had some effect on.
I don't know. We didn't try. Good question.
Yeah, I mean, it also seems that along with the mental process being more complex than a single function, that the whole concept of lie is very complicated. And that, for instance, something where, if I say, well, this was how I really went on vacation, and then someone says, well, let's call it the mountains instead of the seashore, is almost the mental process is more like storytelling and recall, because it's minus the guilt function. I know Ekman and some other people's work in looking at lies have really divided them more along the lines right. of what someone's guilt was. So even if you knew you were lying, but you really felt completely justified, is a very, according to him, is a very different process than if you feel very conflicted about it.
Right.
The issue is the personal emotional conflict.
That's why we have one of the dimensions, high and low emotion. I'm sure he's right about that. So when we talk about lying, we mean attention to mislead, basically to your own advantage. So it's got to be an intention, and you've got to be misleading them, either through omission or commission.
So when, in the beginning, when you showed the different individuals with the very varied rates, and you'd said you'd were they all asked to replace the same sort of thing? Were they each telling very different stories?
They have different stories. It's all customized.
I mean, one thing I thought would be interesting might be to go back, if you have the data, and see what type of thing they were asked to replace, because some replacements might be more emotionally charged than others. So if I actually took a train somewhere and you said, oh, say that you drove, and I think, so what? But if I said, I went with my children, and then you say that you went alone, I might be very uncomfortable about having erased my kids out of the history. So those may be functioning differently in people's memories.
Interesting. But you're making a point for me, which is that these dimensions probably interact, and depending on how they interact, you're going to get different kinds of brain. I think you're probably right. That's probably exactly why we got, I didn't think of that. It's a really good point. And we do have those data. Good point. Thank you.
Just to build on that point, is there a sense of on the nature of the importance as how the person views it as to, so this is where sort of conscience kicks in, where you have a notion of yourself at all, that there is the magnitude of the lie vis-a-vis some internal state it may affect a whole other set of mechanisms.
There you go, another dimension. I told you it's impossible to enumerate them. That's good. I think you're probably right.
Okay.
So that showed up on the self versus other stuff.
When
we start having lie about themselves, I think that's where your point really comes in. That's a really good point. Okay. Sir?
In your fMRI studies, you had the setup such that when the person was lying, they were kind of lying about everything in a story as opposed to just having... It sounded like, at least from the description, just lying on one factor and keeping everything else true. And so I wonder if some aspect of the big difference you were seeing between the rehearsed lies and the spontaneous lies was the fact that you changed so much in the stories as compared to, say, a
true story. Okay, so that's one of the reasons we wanted to do the behavioral work is because we could randomly interpose where they're supposed to tell the truth or lie. But when you're doing the brain stuff, every time you have them change set, you get a whole lot of activity in the frontal lobe. If you have them telling the truth and then lie, you get this sort of changeover effect, we were worried about that getting in the way of the things that we're looking at. So it was blocked. They had a set of trials where they lied about every single thing. And they were always about the same within a set, work or vacation or whatever. Giorgio has done a bunch of variations on this. I think he has now done with fMRI the event-related where he's changed it, and he still gets the basic result, if I remember properly. That special issue of social neuroscience has a lot of papers in there, many of which are neuroimaging. That's a good point.
Can you say something more speculative about
more where... speculative?
Yes. Okay. Well, in terms of you're not just doing this to figure out whether we can make a good lie detector. I assume you're thinking about lots of other applications, given the depth of what you're doing.
It's basic science. I mean, I want to know what lying is and whether we can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Where's the speculation? Mm-hmm.
Speculation about applications of that once you have conclusive...
I don't think we're ever going to get conclusive. I don't think there's going to be applications coming out of this. I mean, I think that's...
Not at all.
Okay. I think that's the bottom line is, I read this article about 4 days ago about how the Israelis do security at their airports. Anybody happen to see that? It's like 5 layers of security from the minute you drive up. And it's not based on technology. This is the point that just kept hammering home over and over again. It's, it doesn't cost a lot of money to build these fancy machines and all that. You need to train people how to interact, how to interview, what signs to look for and all that. And they're very, very effective. And, you mentioned Ekman. And he claims that some people, the detectives and some forensic psychologists, are extremely accurate. We don't know how. The stuff we're picking up on that no one's quantified.
The facial, the muscles of the face being correlated with brain function, right? That you can then arguably detect
whether someone's, what kinds of, whether they're lying or not telling the truth. I mean, is that...
It's a good idea in principle. We don't know. I mean, I know Ekman claims that he knows, but I don't think it's the case that there's widespread agreement that we know which facial cues to look at.
Different kind of smiles reflect different kinds of, I mean, there are different muscle groups that are affected.
Correct.
Right.
But which ones signal deception? There are people that can use countermeasures. So one of the big issues in lie detection is especially people who are relatively intelligent can come up with ways to game the system. They can come up with countermeasures, things like reframing the question they're asked.
What is is?
Right, exactly.
Nature of is.
Exactly. Yeah. They can reframe it so that things that they're innocent, they respond guiltily. They can just screw up the whole thing relatively easily.
So they create a different internal state that then allows them to generate the external response.
Yep. Yep.
But takes time.
Yep.
Yeah, so you can measure the time.
Well, that was originally in the 80s. There was a report that lies took longer, so all you had to do was look at the response time. But in fact, it doesn't work. And this, in the work that I was just talking about, you don't find a big difference between telling the truth and not. And to the extent you do, there's a slight trend where the spontaneous ones take a little longer. What a surprise. I mean, the rehearsed ones are already memorized.
Sure. Yeah.
So just simple response times alone by themselves.
Yeah,
okay, do it. So. Stuart.
Try to understand something that looks like maybe a contradiction here. On the one hand, you say you probably never have a perfect lie detector. On the other hand, you say there are people who seem to be able to accurately determine. So that's an empirical question.
Yeah.
Suppose that were true, and you can, I mean, your response might be, well, it's just not true. There just aren't such people. But if there were.
Therefore,
it has to be magic.
They have to be sensitive to something, and
right
when we build a lie detector that
does. So I have two responses. First is I'm skeptical of the anecdotal reports. Nancy, do you know? I'm skeptical. It is in the literature, but I don't know how rigorous the tests were and so forth. So I want to see it in my own lab. A. B. I'm prepared to believe that there are some people who can pick up on very subtle cues. It's not magic, but we have to figure out what those cues are. And then the question becomes whether those cues would in fact be equally useful for different types of lies. So what I'm sure has not been done is the experiment where you take the detective who supposedly could detect lies really well, and you run the detective against someone who's rehearsed an alternative scenario, who's lying about the self versus others, and so forth and so forth. And I'll bet you a nickel, and I'm not a gambling man, I'll bet you a nickel that person, that's for me it's a lot, that 25 cents I told you was a big amount, so that calibrated. So I'll bet you that person's pretty good at spontaneous kinds of lies. You catch them on the fly, but it's not going to be so good when they've rehearsed and got it down coherently. That's just a prediction.
And in what way can we confidently say that the Israeli method for finding, you know, whatever is effective?
Well, they have the empirical evidence.
Therefore,
they're looking for a very specific type of deception.
They're looking. That's right.
But still,
for environments where you actually have a multiple.
They're looking for deception that's relevant to a particular context. And they also have some kinds of people in mind who have certain kinds of intentions, and they've narrowed it down. It's the same point about the detective, to the point where apparently they can induce behaviors out of people that they wouldn't otherwise induce if the people weren't guilty.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't having bad intentions. Look, all I know is what I read in this one article. It's about maybe 4 days ago. Anybody else see that?
No.
Where was it?
So there was one that I was reading was actually in the Times, which was...
I think it was in the Times.
...also advocated that we should have, you know, all sorts of machines, even after they said that machines...
Really? I think it was a different article.
So the current guy who's in charge of security at Logan was the former security chief at Ben Gurion. So it's...
That's kind
of
comforting.
In all of our lives.
Okay. Good point. Sir.
Have there been any studies of master poker players who are, experts at reading tells and controlling their own?
That's a really good question. Not that I know of. I wonder, you want to study them on both ends. I mean, maybe they'd be the ones who would be. But again, one of the things that, so I mentioned a big picture point about cognitive neuroscience, that we've taken things that seem intuitively to be unitary and undifferentiated and break them into parts. Is that another one, which is that, unfortunately, an enormous amount of processing is context specific. So if you have people practice and get really good at something, it's amazing how little it generalizes. I mean, it's really very, very sad. Expertise is very content specific. So I would suspect that they might be a little better than average, but it wouldn't be a complete transfer as much as you might think. But it's not, as far as I know, it's not been done. It's a good idea.
So you mentioned that noise is always a problem in doing the MRIs test, but I was wondering if, do you think it would be possible to develop like a profile for an individual, almost like a fingerprint of their mental activity, and using the other information you know about lying for a specific individual to predict whether that person were?
I alluded to that idea where you can do, there are things called neurocognitive localizers, where you give them tests very much like the ones in the MRAP in the scanner and see which areas implement those particular processes. So the Stroop, which areas for that person implement it, and go through the list. And then once you know which areas are implementing a certain process, you can work backwards for other things where you don't know necessarily the processes involved. You just see which areas are activated and say, well, we can't say for sure whether more than one process is implemented in this area, because they sometimes are, but at least this is a hint that the process we've identified with this area might be at work. Okay, so that's the logic of what you're suggesting. The trouble is twofold. One is the dimensions haven't been enumerated, so we don't know for a given person whether it would be relevant that this is something that's really important to them or not, which might activate a whole different set of areas than we would have anticipated. Two is a sensitivity issue, that people differ enormously in terms of how activated their brains get. I mean, I don't know if you looked at the scales, but we're talking like 2% difference in activation level as a function of tasks, 2-3%, sometimes a lot less. So these are very small effects in the brain that are picked up by this current fMRI technique that we're using. It might be a better one in the future. But that's the only direction I could see, what you're alluding to, that might have a hope, but again, it's too many dimensions to enumerate them all. It's open-ended, it's open class, A. B, which ones are relevant for a given person, what situations not foreordained. C, there's always going to be a sensitivity issue. So I hate to be so pessimistic, but I think it's justified. Yes?
There's always a lot of work in sort of the lie deception things about the difference between real settings and laboratory settings.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that struck me when you talk about that 25 cents is for a different context, I was just reading Ambari's work on thin slice perception. And one of the things she talks about is that people are much better at quickly reading things like anger and fear than they are at positive emotions. If you're picking faces out of a crowd, people pick out those sort of much more negative but more charged emotions. That, for instance, the Israeli police are working with people who are much more motivated by fear. And an interviewer, like a police interviewer, is when you come into a lab, it's like, well, you'll get 25 cents if you do this well. So I think there's also maybe an interesting difference between, you know, even what you would get if you say, here's a pot of $6, but we're going to keep taking money away from it, as opposed to a positive. Mm-hmm.
So Richie Davidson at Wisconsin has been doing this with $1,000.
Uh-huh.
They start off with $1,000, which is real money. They actually see it,
mm-hmm.
$100 bills. And then he's been doing those kind of manipulations. I don't know what he's been finding.
It'd just be interesting to sort of put it in a negative instead of a positive context.
Right. And especially given that people are so risk-averse and so fear-oriented.
Well, and also that it seems that in real life, so much of our issues around detecting deception are around the discomfort and fear of the person deceiving it.
Right. Right. Good point. Yep.
So a somewhat different question. With the device that you had for checking cognitive ability at any given point, what are some of the applications you're seeing for that? Because the first thing I thought of was one of the other places where you said, when you started the talk, you said, you know, we should be looking directly at what we're trying to measure. That if we want to understand what's going on in your mind, we shouldn't be checking your hands, see how warm it is. And one of our common indirect tests is, for instance, checking airline pilots to see if they smoked marijuana 3 days ago, as opposed to saying, what is your cognitive state right now? Would you see this as potentially a replacement for other, beside the point, tests of ability?
So the idea was, instead of starting with a polygraph where we have these convenient physiological measures that we'll look at, we'll go to the brain, use that to characterize the underlying processes that are involved in different types of deception. Then knowing that, we can now go back out again to behavior. But now it's targeted. We've designed the tasks to tap into the processes that we knew were at work in the brain. So that was the logic. So you can use the behavior. I'm not saying you only have to use the brain. You can use the behavior, but it's sort of neurally validated behavior. So in that context, I think your point's very well taken. We were talking about giving this to residents, trying to find out how long they should be allowed to stay up before they should be forced to go to sleep. Truck drivers, long-distance haulers. In fact, at one point we were talking about having a beep go off every 2 hours, and they take the test. It takes about 10 or 15 minutes to go through the whole set, and it would be radioed back to a central log so that if they got in an accident, you'd be able to, for an insurance company, you'd be able to show that, in fact, they were cognitively functional, you know, a certain period of time before that. There were a whole raft of things like that mm-hmm. I think are in the patent application.
It sounds fabulous.
Thank you.
You could use it in clinical trials to test side effects.
So it's being used, it's been translated now into Dutch, Italian, Spanish, French, I think German, I'm not sure. They've all got versions of it, so it's out there.
No iPhone app.
No, we talked about that. I don't know why. I don't know. It's probably my own emotional reaction to the iPhone. I had an iPhone. I got rid of it. I think I'm the only person I know who did that. It's just too slow and too inefficient for what I use it for. But for something like this, it would probably be ideal.
Any other questions?
My earlier question.
Very well.
I'm contrarian. So true.
Do we have any other questions here? Okay.
Have there been any cross-cultural analyses of lying? In other words, how different cultures define lying and maybe...
That's a good question. And there have been some studies. I don't know the results. I know that they exist. The interesting thing for me is to look at guilt versus shame-based cultures. So I don't know if anybody's done that systematically. I'm not aware of it.
Can you elaborate on guilt versus shame-based cultures?
Yeah, right. It's sort of roughly aligned with the old individualist collectivist mm-hmm. culture, so it's not perfectly correlated, but individualist cultures tend to be more guilt-oriented, mm-hmm. collectivists more shame-oriented, because shame is a social emotion. You know, if Sartre had that thing about you're picking your nose in a room by yourself, how do you feel? How do you feel if you know there's somebody looking at you through the keyhole? Mm-hmm. It's a social emotion in a way that guilt has been internalized. I mean, you know, Freud's idea of the superego. You don't need anybody else. You carry them around with you. That's how you feel guilt. So the notion would be that if you're from a guilt-based culture, as I assume ours is, at least in my case, my subculture, I'm going to be more emotionally reactive in certain contexts than if shame-based, in which case I'll be more emotionally reactive in other contexts. I mean, it's going to be... So it's yet another dimension. Thank you. So, as you said, I wasn't kidding that you can keep enumerating these dimensions on which lies are going to vary, all of which will probably interact.
Okay, well, good. So
if you could keep someone captive long enough to do a huge battery of all these different permutations to their personal baseline, could you then tell?
That was his question.
Yeah.
Yeah, same question. The answer was, we don't know all the dimensions. And we've invented two more in this little meeting just today. And they probably interact. So it's not clear how many tests you'd have to give, A. B, we don't know how they would interpret or frame a given question. So we won't know in advance which dimensions are going to be relevant. C, there's sensitivity issues. Brains vary. So on that very non-optimistic note, I again reiterate, sir.
When you talk about wanting a lie detection system, it's for specific things like you'd want it for security or for, police investigations. They're kind of context-specific already, so it might be conceivable that you could figure out what dimensions are relevant to the typical criminal investigation or the typical, like at the Israeli airport, there's only a certain number of things you have to be aware of. You don't need to care if they're lying about their wife or whether, there's only a certain specific set of...
It sounds good. You might be right, but another take-home message from psychology is the most important reality is the perceived reality. So people tend to frame things and interpret things in individualistic ways. So even if the objective reality is just as you say, for a given person it might be important, another person it might not be important. For somebody else, they come from a shame-based culture, they're going to be thinking that if I don't do this, my comrades in arms are going to be down on me, and so I'm going to feel bad by not doing the thing that someone from a guilt-based, see what I'm saying? So there's all, it's just, the space of dimensions is so vast, and the number of interactions just becomes geometrically explosive. I'm not even sure geometric is the right word. It's just combinatorially explosive. I just don't see it. But if it was ever going to work, it would be the direction that you're talking about. Yes?
Read some articles about in the past about, they were talking about a new way of doing polygraph where they try to do these questions where they ask you a question they know you're going to lie about, and they ask you a question they know you're going to tell the truth, and then they just try to look to see which one it's closer to. And then these other ones where they ask, they ask you a series of questions where they say, was the victim stabbed? Was they shot? And the idea is you just measure and see which one reacts differently from others. Do you think that idea of trying to sort of just establish this, which one is not like the others kind of test,
it's been done for years and years. It's not new. It's been done for years and years. I don't want to get into a whole launch on polygraph techniques. There are three basic different types. But they have a calibration phase, and they do look at that, and it doesn't work.
You have all these interacting factors that you've been enumerating that will sort of overwhelm any attempt to try to create.
The problem may be that there's no emotion associated when they're told to lie. They're just doing what you tell them to do. Mm-hmm. And then when they're actually turned loose and they're supposed to be telling the truth and they do lie, it's a whole different set of processes that come to bear, which have different sequelae. So there have been some very smart, clever people who've tried to use the polygraph in creative ways. Mm-hmm. This is not just, randomly thrown out kind of, it's really thoughtful, and it just hasn't worked out. It's not in principle that it couldn't have, although in retrospect now, at least from my perspective, in principle we should have known better, but at the time you can't blame them when they started doing this work.
So is it well understood that polygraphs don't work?
Yes, there was a National Research Council report done about 10 years ago or so, if I remember right, which reviewed the literature. I went and spoke to them, other people went and spoke to them. And it says, I have no idea.
They're presumably still used.
Well, 80% maybe, and the best with a really talented polygrapher, better than chance, but not good enough for individual items to be confident. So it's better than chance, but not good enough.
It's an interrogation technique.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
That if you say, look at this, it's so okay, I confess.
Mm-hmm. That's what I meant when I said it.
It preys on the lack of sophistication
of
the person being tested.
I think that's exactly right, and that's why it doesn't matter if it's plugged in or not.
That's right.
Yeah. It should be self-defeating over time. Right? Well, once it becomes well known that it doesn't matter if you plug the thing in.
Most of the people being tested haven't read the literature.
Believe it or not.
We could run a test on that and see. Mm-hmm. You'd probably find a correlation that'd be pretty strong.
Yeah.
I think you're probably right, in part because there is this report that people with higher intelligence are better able to come up with countermeasures, and it's not reliable for them. Valid for them, I should say. And that probably is correlated with who reads the literature, although it's totally a correlation, not a causal effect.
So, it seems that putting more evidence together that says, lie detectors are not a valid way, aside from sort of as an interrogation tool, are not a valid way of getting at the truth, is certainly a big contribution of this work. From a scientific standpoint and sort of advancing our understanding of cognition, what do you think the direction of this is? And
I think it's going to meld in with other areas of psychology like memory. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between a false memory and a lie? Mm-hmm. What's the where does rehearsing an alternative reality cross the bounds from something, a strategy you're using to help deceive people, to something that you've actually built into your own psychology and is now starting to bear on other things you thought you knew? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is a piece of something much broader. You mentioned mental imagery at the beginning. Mm-hmm. What's the role of mental images in spontaneous lying? I didn't mention it, but some of the mm-hmm. areas that activated during imagery are also activated during spontaneous lying, probably because they're visualizing what's a plausible response, mm-hmm. right? So what you're starting to see is how individual kinds of activities draw on a broader range of more basic abilities mm-hmm. and how those abilities work together to accomplish different ends. So I think that's the bottom line, is the brain is nonlinear, it's complicated. It's not going to be like a computer where we can say, that's the that center, there's the hard drive, there's the CPU, it's this organic biological thing. And to try to pull the meatloaf apart at its joints, so to speak. Sorry. It's going to take a lot of conversion. I didn't make that up. I forgot who did that. Pull the chicken apart at its joints, nature, understand it. It's not going to be that simple up there. So this kind of work is going to be one way in on mm-hmm. trying to understand the way the more basic faculties operate and interact.
Would there be any way to apply your work or the work that you and your colleagues have done to understanding the process of intentional lying, essentially in propaganda, in various deceptive realms where people repeat something so many times it may cease to become a lie to them, or that to understand that the process, we live in the middle of it all the time. Is there anything move in that direction in terms of social stuff?
It's a good question. I haven't thought about it. It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm skeptical, because if you can't characterize the underlying processes of lying for an individual, how can you then import it to the group? But sometimes you can. So, we don't understand individual psychology all that well, but economic laws sort of work in some circumstances. So you can get these emergent. No, it's a very good question. It's worth thinking about. I haven't thought about it.
Because the differences are statistical. It might
exactly.
work on a larger scale.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. The wisdom of the crowd sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. Society.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.